Hello, everybody, and welcome back. Today we are joined with Taylor Amayas. Taylor Amayas, how are you
Hello.
doing today?
I'm good. There is sun in Seattle today, which is always a good thing. So I'll take it.
That is fantastic. Okay, start off, name, pronouns, how you identify racially and religiously.
Great questions. My name is Taylor Amayas McGee. I use she, her, and they, them pronouns. I identify as a Black, biracial, queer person. And I'm a follower of Jesus. Christian has a lot of loaded language behind it, so we'll do that.
Sounds great. How very, very broad and very bold question to start off with. How do you feel about being black in today's world?
Oh, that's a real easy question.
Okay.
Gosh. Well, I love being black and I love my culture and my heritage and my history. I love my family very dearly. And I think that I do have such, I live in my own kind of little world in terms of blackness and don't see it as monolithic. And so, and think of like being black in America, I feel like most non-black Americans view blackness as this like one kind of idea, and that's what's stereotyped in the media, or that's what you would actually kind of think of, or maybe like you'll think of Obama, or but most of the time I feel like people kind of think of like economic disparities or any other kind of disparity or disenfranchisement. But then I kind of live in this world where how I ended up identifying as black is really different than how I think a lot of people understand, and what blackness means to me and the spaces I'm in is not the same, because of just the way that it is like being Black in America. It is, we're all part of the African diaspora, and so you have people from different cultures, different backgrounds, different interests. And I would say, having lived in different regions of the US now, I think being Black in America is somewhat the same wherever you go. I think it was kind of shocking for me to realize that anti-Black racism pretty much exists everywhere, and it kind of comes in the same forms everywhere you go. It's just not always as blatant, as it would be in the South, where I'm originally from. And so it's this mixed kind of bag, haha, mix, because I'm also mixed, which is a big part of what it is like for me being Black in America and the perceptions that people have of me, and how people see me versus how I self-identify, and just all these other kinds of things that come into having different aspects of privilege for being lighter skinned, but also having not a lot of privileges in a lot of other cases. But I would say I love being Black and I love where I come from, and who I am, and kind of F anyone who wants to challenge my blackness, number one, and number two, continue to say that blackness is one kind of thing, and if you're not that, then you're not black.
What is your kind of blackness, or how
I knew you were gonna ask that
you knew
question.
it
Oh, I knew it. I could feel it brewing. I don't know. I think a lot of, I would kind of categorize my blackness based on values, rather than like specific kinds of traits. And so servant leadership is 100% one of those things. A heart for justice, a prioritization of family unit and family structure. I think food, man, I miss like good greens and cornbread and black-eyed peas, and that just being the staple. I think the Black American religious experience, I would definitely consider myself part of, whether that's like the Black church or whether it's just the reliance on God and spirituality as something that strengthens us as a people. I would say with that, my blackness very much falls into this place of ancestral healing and a mindfulness of that, that I think a lot of Black folk don't have the privilege of having such an intimate connection to it as I do. I'm also like a black outdoorsy person. That is something that I have really kind of slowly stepped into, that there's a good amount of black folk who are really into outdoors or like foraging or hiking. And that is a place that I feel culturally, because black environmentalism has existed for since we were created. And so I would kind of attribute myself to that. Yeah, that's what I would kind of categorize it as.
So we were specifically talking about being black, but part of that is definitely being mixed. And so how does it feel being mixed? And do you feel like you fit in anywhere? Do you feel like you are enough as a mixed person?
It's a wonderful question and something that I think about all the time. I think I never really like knew that I was mixed until I had my first racist encounter in high school, because it even though I have a white mom and a black dad, there was always this kind of sense of equality and equanimity between us. I think what's also hard for a lot of people to kind of grasp is that I didn't really have a much relationship or connection with my mom's side of the family at all. And so I didn't grow up with the white side of my family. And I grew up in a city that was predominantly black. And so I spent so much of my life in just kind of multi-ethnic, multicultural settings. And with my dad's entire side of the family, that rather than it being about where do I fit in, it was I always kind of assumed that I could just be me and it wouldn't be a problem and people wouldn't question it. That changed when I got into high school. And even though I was in a public school and I was in the gifted program, that's just modern day segregation. And that was really difficult. And so then there were kinds of issues of, not seeing yourself represented in your teachers, or not seeing, playing the game of like, all right, how many people of color are going to be in my class today? Or if I go to this football game, like, is it going to be like the mostly white school against the black school? And like, where am I supposed to kind of go? And I think now I don't have as much insecurity of my racial identity of being mixed, based on other people around me. I think I'm still aware of it, but I don't let it kind of impact my own self-image in a lot of ways. But it's complicated again, because I didn't grow up with my mom's side of the family. And so there's this kind of weird cultural things that are always going to be strange to kind of wrestle with. Especially now living in a region of the US that has some of the lowest population of Black folk, it is a very different kind of experience. And like, will people read me as Black when the people who are Black here don't look like me, versus in the South? I mean, the joke is like, we're like, you got high yellow people who are light skinned, African American folk, everybody got something. And it just wasn't a question. Until I moved to places where it became a question of people trying to figure me out rather than just see me as like this person. But I also think I stopped code switching a couple years ago because I just felt it was exhausting. I stopped code switching in professional spaces because it was like you could tell that like white Taylor Mayes is the person who's going to do this interview. And then 3 months down the line, when I'm in the job, I'm a completely different person when that completely different person is just me and who I've always been. And so I think mixed people, biracial people, we walk this really challenging line of always being in between, but also neither nor all the time, everywhere you go. And it's up to us to kind of figure out who we want to be, what spaces we want to be in, how do we want to show up in those spaces. And I think it is a true gift and a privilege to be able to kind of engage in that imagination process and get to create this entirely new thing, but also rejecting people who are trying to put me where I am supposed to go, because it will always change and is always in flux.
So my original next question was going to be, do you code switch? But you answered that. So what is code switching to you? If you want to give like a quick definition, because I understand it is different to everyone, but then what it is specific to you?
So code switching is something that people of color from various backgrounds use to describe the experience of going from talking like a white person and performing whiteness and all those things and switching into that in order to be perceived as respectable or perceived as like not the kind of stereotype or the negative things about that said race or culture, ethnicity. I think that there also, I think there's a little bit of gender that gets put into code switching as well, where you've seen women who would typically identify as female will code switch to be viewed as a more dominant person in a workplace that is predominantly male. We have women wearing suits or just those kinds of things. And so if that's kind of what code switching is at large, for me, code switching a lot of times has existed in presentations all the time. What's interesting is preaching is a different thing. It's kind of interesting, but presentations or public speaking or things like that, it's using very proper language and changing your tone of voice and making it seem very palatable and blah 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 blah. And then I'll just like go back to talking how I've been talking so far. And now that in professional spaces too, I mean, I got so used to kind of carrying myself a certain way and having my hair not down. I would put it up so you people wouldn't know that it was super curly and trying to kind of live into what people expect from someone who is lighter skinned, and kind of stepping into that. I think being mixed race means code switching is different because a lot of times people perceive mixed race people as being neither race that they actually are, in the sense of people think I'm Latinx or Hispanic all the time. And now I'll get like Brazilian, or I'll get like Dominican or Puerto Rican, or I'll get Mediterranean, just kind of all over the map. And so you even have that of the code switching of like, if I'm around like Latinx and Hispanic people, I take on the kind of accent of that space just because it's easier to do it, rather than having to kind of consciously think about who I actually am. And so even in friend groups and things like that, it's kind of different. But now I don't really do it. It's just kind of a waste of my personal peace to constantly change how I'm talking and looking. And I'd rather just live my life. And I chose a career that I get to wear sneakers and hoodies because I'm a little bit of a sneakerhead and I love hoodies. So that is something that I chose.
How do you, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this question, but how is it being queer with your parents' religion? You can.
Oh, that's a great question. Oh my gosh. So both my parents come from Christian families, Christian households, those kinds of things. However, even though both my parents are Christian and are both from Texas, the way that they have landed is completely different. I think both my parents, the caveat is both my parents also went to seminary. So they have a very different understanding of Christianity than the average kind of Christian. And so I think in general, both my parents are very welcoming and they understand just the nature of like an all-inclusive God or an expansive God and things like that on a theological level. I think for both of my parents, when I came out, it challenged all their beliefs. That it's one thing for like to be friends with queer people, which they were, and it's another thing to kind of acknowledge expansive language for God and embracing theologies that were opening. Because at the time when they were in seminary, queer theology was not called queer theology. This was late 80s, early 90s. But then when it's your kid, it challenges how you understand the world. I think fundamentally, my parents don't want any harm to come to me or don't want me to experience any more hardship than I already do in the world. But it hasn't always landed well. I think my parents took more issue with me once I started studying queer theology and getting really invested in that rather than me being a queer person who loves Jesus. That was not really a thing. My dad, my dad's my best friend. We talk about everything. And he would go to bat for anyone and has, there have been times if I get some kind of hateful message from either from any kind of religious space I'm in, he'll read it and he'll say, like, this is wrong and here's why, here's a theological perspective on it, and the eunos is not true. And he'll sit down, read the homophobic and the transphobic emails and letters and stuff that I get, and say, this is wrong, this is why, I don't believe this, this verse, they haven't interpreted it right, they haven't translated it. And my mom has done the same. And so because of that, they know how to kind of defend. But what it means for your kid who is also part of this, I think that they struggled. I think they honestly took a lot more difficulty with me clinging to Black theology than they did queer theology, of the amount of investment I had in Black theologians and womanists. I think that they were kind of caught off guard with that, and they weren't ever kind of expecting me to be the source of kind of my belief, because that was not something. I didn't grow up in church, neither of my parents went to kind of racialized churches. They both went to United Methodist churches, and it was just the thing that you did. And so for it to become racialized theology, I feel like they took more issue with that. Because that honestly was a lot of how I figured out and why I began identifying as Black, was because of that. And the same thing of queer, of why I kind of identified as queer, was coming from being able to read those perspectives from queer folk. But I think now that I'm a pastor, I think my parents, again, they just don't want me to experience any harm of it. There's a very different experience of being a queer person of faith versus being a queer pastor. It's a very different experience. Add being a queer pastor in a predominantly heteronormative, cisgendered church and a predominantly white church. It's a very interesting experience that even my parents, they're like, oh, we understand like what you mean when you say that it can feel like wrong being here, or feel like you have to kind of change or present yourself in a different way, and how it can feel inauthentic or performative. But I say from like a faith theological level, they're there and very supportive. From a practical daily life level, I think they're still trying to kind of reconcile that. And I would say my dad is more on that route than my mom, but I think that they're both kind of just trying to figure out what that is like. Prime example, right? Parents, still involved in theological spaces, colleagues, whatever. And, how do they respond when they have a longtime friend who is not affirming, and ask about what their daughters are doing when I don't identify as female? How do they, in that moment, what do you do? And I don't think that they always know what to do in that moment, and trying to navigate that. Then it becomes an issue of, did they raise their children right in the right faith? That if you have like a daughter and then you have a child. And so there's other questions that come up for them as parents in theological spaces, in places of worship and those kinds of things, that I think that they're not really expecting or knew really what to do. And I don't think anyone would. But I don't know, they love me and they support me and they let me move 3,000 miles away from them to do it. I'm called to do. So I'm a guess that they trust in the Holy Spirit enough to let me do my thing.
Absolutely. Was it hard being your authentic self, being a full person aside from, counting yourself as a person, not counting yourself as a Black, queer, non-woman?
Just a person. Oh my gosh. Oh, Lord Jesus. Absolutely. I think I only recently started seeing myself in my wholeness as a person once I got in a job where it became exhausting to have to constantly be referred to as, oh, we're so good that we finally have a queer pastor. I was like, no, I'm me. I just happen to be queer. I just happen to be Black. I just happen to be biracial. It is just who I am. And so I think once the fatigue of being tokenized or being seen as this kind of Hail Mary and just the person who has like filled all these boxes, I'm like, I'm not a box. I'm not going to fill anything. I'm my own person. I am whole. God made me this way. And a lot of times, I said this in my job interview. I was like, I'm kind of a palatable queer person and a palatable Black person. I just live my life and I do my own thing. And I just happen to be these things. And yes, they are important to me, and they are important markers of how I live my life and how I navigate this world. But I just like, I don't know, I'm very granola. I don't know. I like working out. I like going hiking. I like Taylor Swift. I'm also a human. I'm also a person as much as I am this kind of person that you don't really view as a person, but just identities that you want to put on a poster to fill some kind of quota, whether it be well-intentioned or not. I'm just not interested in that anymore. Whereas before I was like, oh my gosh, I feel so seen when someone is finally saying I'm a Black biracial person. Yay! No, that should not be the thing that I am excited about being seen by, but do you see me as me and not just the label or term that you seem that you want to use, you know? And that's not to say language doesn't matter. That's just to say I'm just fed up with only being seen as labels and not as a whole being, a whole person. Yeah. I could talk more about that for days, but I'll cut it there.
Definitely. And I will always be happy to listen to your rants. Now I'm opening it up more to if you have any questions, if Faith or Eli have any more questions. I asked my main ones.
You can also go off script. It's okay.
No, I know. I was. I started writing more questions as you're talking. Don't worry. Do you guys have any questions? I can keep going.
I had a question. I actually have a few. I've also been writing them down. We'll start with the most recent question. So you mentioned that your parents really started taking issue with you going into queer theology and Black theology and womanist theology, like as a specific topic rather than just like you as a queer, like biracial person approaching theology. I'm curious to know, like, what was their reasoning behind, like, why that was not, I guess, like the best, quote unquote, like best path for you
that they saw? That's a good question and wonderfully phrased. I'll say that. I mean, my parents read it. Like, my parents went to seminary. They went to progressive seminary. Literally this entire bookshelf is literally just stuff from my parents' bookshelves from seminary. And in their will, I get all of their books. And so my copies of James Cone stuff are my dad's. My copies of books on Christianity, patriarchy, and sexuality are my mom's books. Or books from... I have a book from 1982 about homosexuality in the church from a class that my mom took, you know? And so because my parents had read it, I think that for them, it was something that opened their eyes and helped them gain perspective. But the idea of, oh, this confirmed my identity and this makes sense. And this is something that is, I don't know if they would use the word like radicalize, because that's not in like the typical kind of like political sense or even religious sense, but just like, I think, you know, at the end of the day, I think that they didn't want me to be subjected to the things that I was subjected to in seminary, of the pushback from professors who didn't like that I was using womanists in my papers, or the pushback from not wanting to use the typical queer theology books by Marcel Althaus Reed and wanting to use Peter Chang. You know, I don't think that they wanted from a professional perspective for me to receive any pushback, because they know that I'm intelligent and they know that I'm smart. I think on a personal level, you know, if for ordination, for example, in the Methodist church, when you go through the process, you have interviews, you have paperwork. It's pretty standard for different denominations. I'm in a denomination that's not affirming. I can't name drop and just happen to mention queer theologians as being core to my understanding of Wesleyan theology. I'm going to get denied ordination. And they support me enough to know that they don't want me to go through that rejection as they had gone through their own rejection and ordination process. And so I think a lot of times it felt like they just really cared about like where I was going to end up and my professional kind of outcome. But I think underneath the surface, now that I'm now a pastor and in the ordination process, now I can see you just didn't want me to have the conversations that I'm having or experience the challenges and hurdles that I have to now, But and at the same token, my dad has picked up some of these books again, has read them in a different lens because he now has a queer kid, and it's changed his understanding of it. But I think, at the end of the day, again, they don't want me to experience harm. They don't want me to experience hardship, whether that is professional or not. But I don't think that they would have literally mailed me boxes every month of their old books if they didn't want me to learn these things and be influenced by them. Yeah, I had another thought on that, and I can't remember what it was. I think that that's the thing. I don't think that they were necessarily anticipating me reading those books to be so life-changing that I would dedicate my entire life to being in ministry and doing ministry mainly with queer youth and young adults. I don't think they expected that to be the outcome. And that's the kind of sense of radicalization of what I mean of it. It's not just something that resonates, but oh, because I read Pamela Lightsey's book, I do what I do because I read this book and it changed my life, and I don't know how to not do this work anymore. But they're cool, they're chill, they have interesting thoughts. We have lots of theological conversations.
I guess my next question, kind of taking in everything you just said, is how did you begin to navigate those conversations with your parents about, like, this is what I'm doing now and the direction that I want to take my degree and my time in seminary because I'm reading these books that you've given me, and kind of do all of those, I think of them as like negotiations, and all of those like conversations.
My godparents and my parents had a bet on what age I was going to go to seminary. My dad and my godmother won. And that's to say that I have always been a very deep thinker and a very, like, I won't say intellectual. That's more of my sister. She's been very intellectual. I've always been introspective. And I grew up interfaith, and my parents will always talk about the reason why they kept us in the kind of schools that we were in is because I would almost always surround myself with as many friends who were from outside of the US and had friend groups that were mostly international kids, and just had a natural kind of relationship to it. And so I think that they knew to some degree I would do something with religion. I mean, even when I did doc film and was in the documentary film industry for a couple of years, all of my films were about religion and race. Like, I think they figured enough that I was going to land there. And so there wasn't a lot of conversation about I'm going to seminary and I'm doing this path. The conversation was, do you have to make it about being queer all the time? And do you really need to study queer theology? And do you really need to write all your papers on this, and do you really need to be writing a chapter in a book on this? And so that those conversations a lot of times went down with a lot of times, instead of telling my parents, hey, I'm writing this paper for New Testament on this, it would be, I've written the paper, I got an A on it, please read it and tell me what you think. Because I come from a family of highly educated people with a lot of military personnel. Success and excellence is expected, and that is how I was raised. And so it was easier for me to give them something that I had written and have them just sit with it. Again, they went to seminary, I knew how to read the 20-page papers for my scripture-based classes. They know what I'm saying and how I'm writing. My dad's a librarian at a theology library, so he I'm already kind of with him. It was me kind of being like, hey, I need a book, can you look this up and tell me what you can find? And so he was kind of doing it just from that perspective. But once I gave them my papers and they were kind of reading what I was reflecting on and writing on, I mean, my dad has rarely cried, and he called me one day crying because of what I had written and the magnitude of it and the importance of it. And so rather than being like, hey, most of what I'm learning is about youth ministry and queer theology, hey, do you want to read this paper that I wrote that's about youth ministry and queer theology? And then I'll tell you about this job that I just accepted. Yay, thanks. What seems to go down, but I mean, it's kind of like coming out. That's how I came out. I wrote a letter to my parents and I let them sit with it, and I just kind of came back when they were ready to talk about it, then we talked about it. But that they do better with that. My dad is here for it. My mom, I think she still has some ways to go. But they have been, I'd say, in seminary and choosing this path, they have been far more supportive of this than of other like routes that I had considered in the past. And I don't really think it's about professional things. I mean, like, I can get fired at will, as most pastors can. You know, it's not like there's job security in being a pastor, and it's not like ordination is easy. But I think that they can see the impact that I am making on other people and the impact that I'm having from it, that I think those negotiations and those conversations was more about how can we support you, and we may not be on board, but we love you, rather than you shouldn't be doing this and here's why and we're not going to support you, which is what I thought would happen, but it didn't happen.
Eli, if you don't mind, can I jump in?
Of course.
What is your relationship with Rebel? What is your finding this space? What does that mean to you? Because I feel like that's a huge, not only because it's a Firing Youth Ministries podcast, but because I know that can be amazing space to find a place where queerness isn't the abnormal, where you weren't a queer pastor to me. You were just a person that I connected mm-hmm. with, not only being biracial and understanding some things that I fundamentally can't explain. You just understood, but to me, you were just a person. What was that like for you?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. I was part of Rebel for 2.5, almost 3 years. And that was a place that I had initially kind of been searching for myself, as someone who was kind of interested in pastoral leadership, but didn't really know what the fuck that meant. Or like, was it even possible for someone like me to become a pastor or work in ministry? It was also a place that I was hoping to start making sense of the call that God had given me, which very succinctly put is, I want to be the person that I never had growing up, but desperately needed as I was coming out and also figuring out my racial identity. And I felt like, you know, doing it with high schoolers, then I feel like that would be a good place to do it. And yeah, I mean, it was the place where I figured out how much I love worship music, and it was just something that like I just did because churches asked me to do it, rather than, oh no, this is how I talk to God and I can't do anything. Like, I praying is weird or journaling is weird, but worship music and all of that. And it was a space for the time that I was part of it that was very nourishing and very healing for me to get to see people like you all, who I was not bold enough to just pick a different name and use different pronouns when I was y'all's age. Hell fucking no. I was not brave enough to, you know, I had the internet. Tumblr was like the only place you really could go when I was y'all's age of trying to find like queer community. I would joining a Zoom call with random ass people I've never met from all over the world and just kind of hoping it goes well, that was not something I would have ever had the courage or bravery to do. And so I felt like when I was part of Rebel, it gave me a lot of permission for like to also be bold, as someone who is not a very like super outgoing person. I think it also helped me to learn how to be bold and speak my mind and speak my truth and not be afraid of the outcome. It was also really helpful as I was discerning what it meant for me to be a pastor. Could I be a pastor? Could I go down this path of working with youth all the time? I did not think I was going to be a youth pastor. But because of Rebel, that was something that I was like, dang, I really like this. And like, this is something that I love watching these like kiddos grow. And y'all aren't kids, but like I always call you my kids because like, dang, like I've known some of y'all for like since y'all were freshmen in high school. Now y'all are seniors and it's weird as hell. And I'm like, bro, what? And that's why I love what I do every day. But I think it was also a place that as much as you all were learning, you all and students were learning all these different theologies and making sense of it, I was too. You know, I had done the deconstruction part. And so a lot of ways I felt like I was just one step ahead of the students, but I wasn't always because I was still kind of understanding things. And that was a big reason why I ended up leaving Rebel, that I felt like it wasn't a place that I needed for my own faith anymore, that I, you know, the kind of explorative thinking or the being introduced to new ideas was not something that I found was nourishing anymore. And I love y'all very dearly, truly, but being a full-time youth pastor, the last thing I want to do with my spare time is like do other youth ministry things. I did not think I was going to be a full-time youth pastor ever in my entire career, and that is what my first job at a seminary is. And so I started coming to Rebel, and it felt like work still, and it didn't feel like community. And because so many of my kiddos were now seniors or in college, the culture had changed. And I think that's a good thing. And I think it's a beautiful thing that Rebel has continued to evolve based on the students that are a part of it. But also with that, we all grow up, we all evolve and change. My own beliefs have changed. I don't have as much, I mean, I'm a pretty traditional Christian sometimes. Like I have very like traditional values and very things that don't always fit in queer Christian spaces. And I think that that's okay. And not to feel like Rebel had to be the place where it had to be for every single queer person who likes Jesus all the time, that it is okay for it to have its own little space and its own niche. And it's also okay for me not for that to be my source of spiritual like life and nourishment. But I would not be who I am today without it. I would have not figured out what job and career I wanted to go into without it. I would not have such strong relationships with my students if I hadn't done it. And it's now fun to like be friends with my students and not just like, I'm your leader, yay, and I'll make you cry during worship, yay. That it's, you know, I would not be preaching if I did not have all the practice of giving talks. I hate preaching, y'all, but I can do it because of Rebel. And so it's such a beautiful space to learn, to grow, to figure out who you are, because it is all just you can do whatever you want. And there's not enough spaces like that. And I'm always grateful for it. And I will always tell, like, I tell some of my students in my youth group, I was like, hey, if you're queer and you want a space, please go to this. It's really wonderful. There's great people. I promise you'll get along because all of y'all are really fucking different, but all y'all are also really similar. And somehow it's just really beautiful. And I love it. So even though I'm gone, yeah. I'm here.
No, you certainly are. I love texting you.
Please do.
But not to be sappy, but you were talking about how you wish you had that person. And for me, you are that person. Even though you were not in Rebel anymore, I think about you a lot, not in a weird way, but like,
it's okay. There's still room for Jesus. You can let it be weird. It's fine.
You know, God put you in my life for a reason. And fun fact, Taylor and I met in Boston, and that was an incredible day. I think my mom wanted to murder me by the time I was home because I kept talking. But, you know, I think she was happy that I found someone that, again, like I said, understood me without having to say it. And your music, I have literally run to my living room to show my mom. I was like, she got excited for that time as well. Like, you should come out with like an album because I listened to like the playlist you gave me. But now I want like a Taylor Mayes playlist, like not one you made, like just of you. Or you can just send it to me. Honestly, you want to like free time record some videos? Just send them to me. With all your free time now. With all your free time now. But what is your call to God? What do you believe it is?
Oh my God.
What? I know. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Well, you can't be sappy and then ask a deep as fuck question and expect me to just be like, oh, anyways, here's Wonderwall. Yay, God. Happy go lucky. Fuck. Dang.
We can always.
I don't know. I'm called to keep queer kids alive. And alive in spirit and actuality. You know, I'm very transparent about my mental health and the challenges that I have and the joys that I have. I'm grateful that I have access to the resources I need with therapy and medication and all of that. So my stupid brain can get its shit together and get its chemicals figured out. But in high school, I didn't really have that. You know, I know what it's like to really be struggling. And I know what it's like to stay up till 2 a.m. crying and taking off ace bandages off my chest. I know what it's like to cut all of my hair off and how liberating it feels. I know what it's like to, even though my hair is long, half of it's still shaved because it's just something I've always done. I know what it's like to want that first time you get to wear a piece of clothing that makes it you feel like you. I know what it feels like when you've heard all of this bullshit theology and rhetoric saying that you're not loved and you weren't made by God and you're sinful and you are sin and all of that, and then to be met with the complete opposite and for that to set you entirely free. And just because I know what all that feels like, I know that people, so many youth don't. And if I can have one person be impacted by what I say or do, amazing. But I do think that, you know, God has called me to not just keep queer kids alive in actuality and do the activism and all of that stuff, but also to enliven their spirits and help them with their spiritual growth and formation and the sacredness and the belovedness of that journey, because it is different. And I mean, there's no greater joy for me than having a youth group at my church that is predominantly queer kids and having to sit here and figure out, okay, what VBS curriculum is it going to use? Because it has to be affirming and it has to be by someone that is an affirming publisher and uses inclusive language for God and all of that. I love doing it, and I think there's not enough people doing it, but I think, I don't know, apparently I'm good at it. So I guess I'm doing what God called me to do, and it's going all right.
Okay. Last sappy thing, and I promise I'm done. There was one day where I was crying on my bathroom floor in my school, and the only person I wanted to text was you, and I did. And I was like, how the fuck do you get through school? How do you do this? Because I don't know how. And I knew you would have the answer. And you were like, one day at a time, you just kind of gotta live. And from you, that meant the world, because I knew you understood how hard I was feeling at that moment. So if you want to inspire one kid, you have one kid alive, and a huge part to thank. And Scott, oh my gosh, Scott, I know that you can't say anything, so I get to share my feelings. Sometimes I get sad. I'm like, wouldn't Scott be so sad if I was not alive right now? Like, I think Scott would like mourn. And I was like, can't do that to Scott. Can't do that to Scott. Then he'll take care of Faith too. That just be a whole trickle event. Eli said, can we all take advantage of the silent Scott?
No, I so agree that, like, the fact that we can just say anything to Scott and Scott cannot pretend. It's so nice. We can be as sappy as we want.
And Scott,
I
just,
mean,
like,
truthfully, y'all, like, And Scott, Silent Scott, also knows this, and plenty of my friends know this. There were days where I was not doing great when I was in seminary. And I was like, I know that there are going to be so many kids who are not going to know what to do if I am gone. And that's enough for me to stay here. And I'm here. And, you know, y'all matter. You are so loved. Y'all don't even know how much y'all are loved and talked about and prayed for and all that. You do not even know, but I hope that you can feel it on even on the really hard days, because it keeps y'all alive. It keeps me alive. It keeps everyone somehow in this crazy ass kingdom of God that we got placed in. You know, I didn't ask to be here, but I'm glad that I'm here with y'all, you know. I didn't. That's why I did not ask to be here. God just kind of auto-plated me and like brought me in on a snork and left me here. But it's fine. I'm here and y'all are here. That's what matters. It's fine. Silent Scott, go get a tissue box.
Silent Scott, go get a tissue box.
That should be like a sticker. That should be merch.
Okay, we will make that merch. Writing it down. Please. Any last thoughts before we have to wrap up?
I just want to say thank you. You are the reason why I do what I do and why I wake up every morning and love my job. And even before it was a job, you were the reason why I got through seminary and how I finished college in a panini press. And I'm just grateful for y'all. And there are so many kids like y'all, and I really just want Camp to be a thing and have a big old camp of a bunch of queer.
You better come back for camp.
It may or may not be in the works, but that's okay.
We need Taylor and Mayus around the campfire, please. We need those campfire songs.
You got it. Bro, campfire worship, let's go.
That sounds like a dream with that little guitar of yours. I don't even need to be in the bathroom
it's
at that
little,
point.
Don't, it, listen, we can still have it in the bathroom. We can have a fake.
Can we please?
Figure the worst to camp in the bathroom out.
I would love.
Okay, well, thank you, Taylor Mayus. Thank you for joining us. This has been wonderful.
Of course.
Our next episode is figuring more about Taylor Mayus outside. Oh, I'm freezing. Outside of, you know, living in the white man's world. It's always part of my life, but.
Yeah, it's all right. You froze. Was that the end? Was that the deuces? Okay.